Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, and welcome once again to History Dweebs. I'm Tim, and the topic of our podcast today is the Candyman, the Houston Murders. The topic is Dean Arnold Correll, who was an American serial killer, also known, as I mentioned, as the Candyman, who, together with two of his accomplices, David Brooks and Elmer Wayne Henley, abducted, tortured, and murdered at least 28 boys in a series of killings from 1970 to 1973 in Houston, Texas. We'll talk more about all of their dastardly deeds, but before we do, I'd like to introduce my panel. As always, I'm joined by the very lovely and talented, the Queen of Mean, the Empress of Evil, the Mistress of the Macabre, and Satan's Dirty Little Secret, Brandy. How are you today, Brandy?
Somebody stole my Pop-Tarts, Tim. Somebody stole my Pop-Tarts out of my office.
Jesus Christ. I'm
pissed.
You've been talking about that for days.
Well, no, because I just found it this morning.
Seems like days, doesn't it, Colonel?
Well, I just want to know what kind of savage comes in and steals a person's Pop-Tarts.
Thank you. Who does that?
I don't know, but I
went by your... What kind of animal does that?
You know, well, first of all, you don't lock your door, because I walked by your office yesterday. Your door was wide open. I closed it for
you. Well, she got none to hide. Except
my goddamn Pop-Tarts.
Satanic rituals. Are you sure you didn't use them when you were sacrificing the goat?
Well, I'm sorry about it. Besides your Pop-Tarts, which really you shouldn't have in your office, because that attracts bugs and...
And evidently thieves.
You know, the colonel here is ATP, or APT. He's anti-Pop-Tart.
I'm not so much anti-Pop-Tart.
You're pro-bridge. Didn't we discuss that earlier? You're pro-bridge.
I'm pro-bridge, and then, of course, I belong to the anti-cheese college.
Of course.
I just say I prefer me a good toaster strudel.
Yeah. That's fine, but I can't make toaster strudel here. So I take the Pop-Tarts. That is my breakfast.
But Pop-Tarts are not really a pastry so much as a...
No, they're Pop-Tarts.
They're vending machine food.
Yes.
You can't get a good toaster strudel out of a vending machine.
No, you cannot.
Yeah.
That's a true statement.
Well, I'm sorry, Brandy, about your...
I don't think you are sorry. You're being kind of a smartass about it, so...
Are you sensing that I'm condescending?
A little bit?
Well, when we solve the great Pop-Tart caper, we will do a podcast on it.
Yes, we will. Brandy, do you have anything to say before I go to you-know-who?
What am I, Voldemort now?
I haven't introduced you yet. You're not on the dark.
Voldemort. No, because then we couldn't say your name. Don't be dumb. I don't have anything today. I was on a tear earlier about people who are the first car at a light, and you have to make a left-hand turn or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You're the first car to light. Pay the fuck attention, because sometimes light only lasts so long, and if you're fucking on your phone or dicking around and you miss the goddamn light, I'm going to be pissed.
So you have a little road rage.
Yeah. Today's not been great for me. I don't like to come in and play catch-up.
And someone stole your Pop-Tarts.
And someone stole my Pop-Tarts, and I watched a wreck this morning.
Can I just ask you a question?
You're not here yet.
If it's not stupid, which clearly it's going to be, so no, you cannot ask me.
So let me introduce the other member of our panel, the very distinguished and honorable, a man who works with multiple...
dysfunctions?
Well, works with multiple organizations doing charity work. He is the face of our erectile dysfunction and the face of Bloody Stool. That is the... very talented, very honorable Colonel Charles Beauregard Hawk Waters III, affectionately known as the Southern Gentleman. Although I've never heard anyone actually refer to you as the Southern Gentleman.
Or affectionately.
But I'm sure you are. If they do refer to you as a Southern gentleman, it's with affection. So welcome, Colonel. How are you today?
Well, I'm not too good, Timmy.
What's wrong with you?
Did somebody make you wait at a light? Because that would piss me off.
Did someone take your Pop-Tarts?
Well, the Colonel had to go to the doctor and have a procedure done.
What kind of procedure was that?
It's a procedure on your
It's personal matter. And
if it's personal, why are you bringing it up?
They have told me I can no longer be the face of Bloody Stool.
Why is that?
He had his asshole sewn shut.
Yeah.
That's what happened.
Like the lady with no vagina.
Oh, so you're the man without an anus.
I could be.
He's one ginormous anus, so I don't know if it's that much of a loss for him.
Can I ask you a question, Devil?
Yeah.
And I understand the loss of your Pop-Tarts. You're taking them to heart.
Staggering. And Prince.
And what about Billy Paul? The loss of Billy Paul?
Yes!
Mitha Jones. She died.
Mitha Jones.
I just got to ask you this question. I don't want you to
respond. You get to it then?
Do you got the PMS today?
No.
Okay, because you're acting like you got the PMS.
I am not. And just because I am grumpy does not mean I have the PMS.
Well,
We're worried about
it
your
doesn't
mental
mean
health.
That. Well, you should be.
It's
a bad scene all the way around up here.
I don't know what kind of savage takes a person's Pop-Tarts.
Takes a bitch's Pop-Tarts. You know, yeah. I ain't got much. Mm-mm. I don't have much, but I enjoy my Pop-Tarts in the morning. That's what I enjoy. Why are they stealing my joy?
And you had a lot of Pop-Tarts in there, probably.
I took two. I had only eaten two, and it was a big box of Pop-Tarts. Large box of Pop-Tarts.
Oh, that's some bullshit right there.
It is some bullshit. There were 12 in here.
So you got 10 missing tarts.
Keep the box. We need to leave the evidence. I'm going to fingerprint that box for you.
They should.
All right.
Fuckers.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry you lost your Pop-Tarts. Colonel, do you have any shout-outs for
Prince,
us today?
Are you sorry about Prince?
Yeah. I do have a shout-out to Prince. We're going to miss you. I took a little bit of grief because I said, you know, he's kind of the poor man Stevie Wonder.
Fuck yourself.
Yeah, you're stupid.
People are not happy about that.
You are stupid. I just said no. I said no.
No, but he was a fantastic guitar player.
Yes,
he was just amazing guitar.
He was a great artist, and better than Stevie Wonder on his best day.
Stevie Wonder can't even do his own hair.
No,
he can't.
Or dress himself.
No, well, he can, just not
correctly.
Not correctly dresses himself like Chuck.
Well, you know, now you can get it again because you said something about my shirt the last time and Renee jumped on you. You're talking about my clothes. I got it. And most people.
What are you talking about? I think your shirt's nice today.
Yeah, you look nice today.
Well, he called me a gay lumberjack the one day when I had the flannel shirt on.
Because that was fitting. But today you look nice.
Well,
I wish you'd take your badge off because we all know who you are.
Renee.
I did not call. That was Brandy that called you Paul Bunyan. I just said you looked like you were going to chop some wood. That's all I asked. And it just it wasn't coordinated.
Paul Bunyan, and you said a gay Paul Bunyan.
No, it wasn't coordinated. You saw Brandy first, and she called you Paul Bunyan. I had no idea. But then you walked by my office, and I said, "Good morning, Chuck. Are you going to chop some wood today?" That's all I said.
Or blow it.
And I just got to tell you. You talk about my clothing, and I, as you know, the Colonel is a little handicapped in the sight department. I'm colorblind. The Colonel's colorblind.
Oh, like sight.
Like a dog.
Sight.
Much like a dog, and I'm colorblind. And so my wife buys all my clothes, and when she buys me my clothes, she'll bring home a shirt, and she'll tell me, "It goes with brown pants, and this tie.
We have a very long podcast. I just want to throw that out there.
It's just getting longer by the minute.
So, no, I'm just saying, if you criticize my clothes, you can bet that the she-devil, the key-stealing, skanky...
Nope. That woman is a saint, and you need to quit speaking ill of her. I will rip on your shirts all damn day long. You will not rip on Renee.
Okay, let me get to my shout-outs.
Thank you.
Backdoor Buttercup.
Why?
Why
do you do that to her?
She's such a cute little girl.
I know. It's really weird and creepy that you call her that.
She's a deviant. You know that, don't you?
Well, again, you and your glass house.
And
Pigeon stones.
And of course, the man who really has to deal with her every day, Chris.
Good guy.
Great guy. Great guy. Fellow vapor. He vapes.
Yeah, he does.
I don't know if any of y'all people know what vaping is, but it's a great substitute for cigarette smoking. Devil, you still smoking?
Yes.
Oh, yeah?
I have children, and so I work with the two of you.
You're smoking, and you're taking illicit drugs. What do you think's going to happen to you?
God, I hope one day that I'm just so high I lose my way.
Please let her continue in her...
Yeah, leave me alone.
Yeah. You don't want to separate her from her tobacco.
We got Tara, of course, and Phyllis. Tara, I'm kicking your ass on the Fitbit, so don't take that too hard. Celine, and Allie with your broken ass toes. You had it coming. You know you had it coming.
Have it coming. Mm-hmm. Get well soon, Allie.
Well, you know what? I can say anything I want about Allie. You know why?
Why?
Because I've already probably said something that made her mad one time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know she's going to finally one day hunt me down and kill me.
Yes.
Because that's how
we all look
built.
Forward to
only,
that day.
Only if I give her a case of beer.
No, Allie built like that. She just... There's something about Allie. She's got that she's got 45 degrees like Timmy on criminal justice, and she got all those degrees to figure out.
Oh, so she can make
out,
you disappear.
Yeah. Right, how not to get caught. That's what her...
And she said she was used... She was mentioning that in one of her previous jobs, she would go in to people's homes after they died. And, you know, these people who would just die, loners.
Yeah.
And then she'd go in and investigate, so...
Yeah, and then she'd have a yard
she's
sale.
She's going to be in your house.
Yes, people did that without ass. She'd have a yard sale.
Yeah.
You know, put their stuff out on the block. Kim Taylor, congratulations to little Ryan Taylor, who won his first baseball game this week.
Good job, Ryan.
Yep. Boy's got a little cannon for an arm.
Hopefully
just to throw baseball.
Hopefully he's not listening to us.
Well.
I hope not.
And, of course, Lady Beverly and Sully. And I'm Facebook friends with Lady Beverly's daughter. She's a beautiful girl. Okay. We're trying to arrange a marriage right now between her daughter and Taylor, my son. We think that will be a nice match.
Win-win.
Yeah, Taylor's a good boy.
We'll unite the kingdoms.
Yes.
And then we'll win Game of Thrones.
It'll be impossible to defeat us.
Clearly.
And, of course,
Trixie is going to overthrow the kingdom, so...
I was about to give Trixie a shout-out.
Yeah, well, she's going to probably...
I believe Trixie's an anarchist.
She's going to have you executed, most likely.
Yeah, she probably will, but not before Allie kills me first.
These people making promises.
Yeah.
The one...
We're on board. You don't have to convince us.
Yeah.
The only... The incomparable.
That means no one compares.
No.
Nothing compares to her.
Nothing compares to her.
No singing.
Sinead O'Connor going to be dead next week.
Did the prince write that?
Is Sinead O'Connor still bald?
Yes.
Is she?
Yes.
No singing.
Oh, okay.
Last I saw her, she was. She may have grown hair by now. Can we get through this?
Well, you know,
we haven't gotten even to the story yet.
And Dottie Scott.
Thank you.
Hold on. Why is the damn impatient all the time?
Because this is a long podcast.
You go off on these rants about stool color, and last time it was about the lady with no vagina.
That's during us going through the story. Interjects those things.
And we have limited...
No, you have limited time before you have to go home.
No, we have to post this. We have limited space for the month of, April. So we don't have much space.
Do you have any shout-outs, Timmy?
Yes. I would like to give a shout-out to Millie and Magnus, who are cats from Cat. You know Cat from Denmark?
Oh, yes.
She showed me a picture of her cats, so 14 years old. Beautiful cats.
So you're giving a shout-out to cats.
Yeah, and to Cat and her cats.
Okay.
Because apparently I cannot say her name correctly. And you two are no fucking help. Because
it's Katja. I told you. It's not.
According to her, it's not. And she should know her own name.
She's from Denmark. She talk funny. It's Katja.
According to her.
Just like Ketchup. Ketchup.
Anyway, I'd also like to give a shout out to John Cunningham. John suggested this topic, so we appreciate that, John. To Glenn Williams, who is a big Cubs fan. They took the Cubs, three or four of the Reds this weekend or something?
Yeah, but they cheated a couple times.
Well, no, they're a good team. So shout out to Glenn. Curtsy. I hope I said your name right.
Curtsy.
Curtsy. Yeah, because I screwed it up last time. So, Curtsy, I hope I did it right this time. Rebecca, Elise, Mary Ray. We haven't heard from Mary Ray in a while. I hope she's okay. Mary Ray, if you're around, say hi to us. And Brandy, do you have any shout-outs?
Well, of course, I want to shout out to all my Team Brandy girls.
Cacklin Hens.
Cacklin Hens. And I want to give a shout-out to Michael.
Michael Birdsall?
Yes, because he was very sweet to me. And post, we conversed a little the other night. And
perhaps he'll order you some Pop-Tarts.
Well, perhaps somebody should reimburse me for my loss.
Right. But okay, and also I want to give a shout out to Alicia.
You were done with your shout-outs.
Chip, I know. I'm just going down the list here. Lydia, you joined us. Please. Erica, Donna, thank you all for listening. Thank you all for being part of History Reads, the podcast page on Facebook. Now let's get into the topic, shall we? The Candy Man.
Yeah, and you kind of threw me. I got to tell you on
the
this
Candy
one,
Man
Timmy.
Can.
Yeah.
Because you kept telling me we were doing one on a Candy Man, and I did all kinds of research, and I got all, I thought it was that little one-eyed man.
You thought it was Sammy Davis Jr.?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry.
The little one-eyed man.
The one-eyed man.
Well, actually, he's dead now.
Dean Martin.
Yeah, he's dead now. Part of the Rat Pack.
A good part of our subjects are dead now.
Yeah. That's true, but this is not about him.
I don't want to talk about anybody now.
I know. I'm bummed about Prince. All right, let's. I'm doing this next podcast. We've got another podcast coming up hopefully later this week on suicide jumpers from the Golden Gate Bridge, and I'm like totally depressed in this research. So
awesome!
They jumped off a bridge.
It's depressing.
You know what happened? These people was all friends. They was all friends. I mean, just like your mama said, if your friend jumped off a bridge, would you jump off a bridge?
That's true.
Well, you know.
They did.
There were like 1,700 of them.
Yeah.
806 of them were friends.
All right. Thank you, Colonel. Well, we'll look forward to it. We'll talk more about that next time.
Thank you, Colonel, but shut the fuck up already.
All right. Yeah, he tends to more and more tense.
Dean Arnold Carell. And it's spelled fucked up. Let me first say his name. He can't even spell his own fucking name. He spells his name C-O-R-L-L. There should be an E in there. Do you agree or not, Colonel?
It's the stress getting to you there, Timmy.
Should his name not be spelled C-O-R-E-L-L?
I'm just going to say you seem a little cross to me, Timmy.
I'm just saying the fucker don't even know how to spell his own name.
I believe his name might be Dean Corll.
Like Dean Corll? Well, that still isn't spelled right.
He's missing a vowel. So
yes, he's missing a vowel. He needs to buy a vowel. Anyway, Dean was born on December 24th.
Have you gone off your meds?
Hey, listen, I'm telling the story.
Okay, I'm just, you're
wild. Listen to it.
You better hope not. He's going to beat the shit out of you.
Listen to this date, Colonel. He was born on December 24th, 1939.
Oh, his mama was full. No, she wasn't pregnant during the holiday because she was. Oh, she was all split up and Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
but man, that was no fun Christmas at that house.
All right. So anyway, they're from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Of course, you're very familiar with Fort Wayne, Colonel.
I don't know a damn thing about Fort Wayne.
It's the next state over. I figured you go to Chicago, you probably...
Well, it's the next state over for you and the devil, too. What the hell do I know about Fort Wayne, Indiana?
All right.
I don't really think about it. Is it actually in Indiana?
I was trying to give you a little credit for your geographical knowledge, but apparently it's limited. Dean was the first child of Mary Robinson and Arnold Edwin Carell. I guess we can't blame him. It's probably his dad that doesn't know how to spell his name. His father was very strict with his sons, and his mother was extremely protective of them, especially of Dean. The marriage of Dean's parents was marred by frequent quarreling.
They were arguing.
How about that? And the couple divorced 4 years after the birth of their young son Stanley in 1942. So we got Dean born in 1939 on December 24th, Christmas Eve. He was like Jesus, I guess. And then Stanley was born 3 years later in 1942. Now Mary, the mother, sold a home and relocated to a trailer in Memphis, Tennessee. They grew up there. Dean grew up there. And His parents tried to reconcile their marriage, but it didn't work out. Dean was a shy child. He was very serious. He seldom socialized with other children and had a tendency to display concern and well-being for others. At the age of 7, he suffered from rheumatic fever, and he was which was they only discovered that in 1950. So but he had a heart condition as well. So he was ordered to avoid physical education at school. In 1950, Dean's parents remarried, and they moved to Pasadena, Texas. But the reconciliation was short-lived, and in 1953, the couple divorced once again, with the mom retaining custody of her son. Following their second divorce, the mother married a traveling salesman named Jake West.
Was he a hobo?
I don't know. And the family moved to a small town of Vidor, where Gorel's half-sister Joyce was born. And this is all really pretty boring stuff.
You wrote this show.
I know, man. I don't know what I was thinking. But anyway, it was here in Vidor that his mother and stepfather started a small candy company. Thus, he'll get to the name the Candyman, right?
There we go.
Operating it out of a garage in their home. And Dean was working day and night while still in school and working at the candy store. So, he was somewhat a loner. Dean was somewhat of a loner in his teenage years.
That's a surprise.
His only major interest was in the high school band, in which he played the trombone. Did you ever play in the school band, Colonel?
I did not play the. Now I heard the devil over here play the mean skin flute.
Really?
She also played softball.
She did play softball.
I was in college.
Yeah. So
wait a minute. I don't know. You got the all access pass to the other building. I'm not sure you need to be talking about anybody playing the skin flute. To get that access, I think that's what you did.
You do what you need to do.
Dean was a well-behaved student and achieved satisfactory grades prior to his graduation. Following his graduation in 1958 at Vidor High School, it was probably VHS is probably what they went by.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. The family moved to the Heights District of Houston and opened a new shop, which they called the Pecan Prince. Clever name.
It is.
In 1960, Dean moved to Indiana to live with his grandparents. Back to Indiana, probably Fort Wayne. I'm sure you're very familiar with Fort Wayne.
I don't know a goddamn thing about Fort Wayne.
He stayed in Indiana for almost 2 years, forming a close relationship with a local girl. But he returned to Houston in 1962 to help the family's candy business again. They just couldn't do without him. He later moved in an apartment above his own shop. Dean's mother divorced Jake West in 1963 and appointed Dean as the vice president of the candy company. Mm-hmm. So here he is, VP already at the young age. That same year, one of the teenage male employees of the candy company complained to Dean's mother that Dean had made sexual advances toward him. That seems unseemly.
I don't like the sound of that at all.
In response, the mother fired the employee. So,
well, yeah.
That solved that problem. Despite his heart condition, Dean was drafted in the United States Army on August 10th, 1964, during the buildup in the Vietnam War, and he was assigned to Fort Polk in Louisiana. I know you know about Fort Polk.
I do not know anything about Fort Polk.
Okay, well, he was there for basic training. While in the service, Dean started to display the first signs of flagrant homosexuality.
Yeah, what was he going to musicals all the time, or what?
I don't know. He was later assigned.
Did he start dressing nicer? What did he do? Made sure his uniform was pressed tightly, or what?
I don't know.
Probably had a shirt like yours.
While in the service, that was a pretty good one for him. While in the service, he started this. All right, I already said that. He was later assigned to Fort Benning, Georgia. I know you're familiar with Fort Benning, Georgia.
I have spent many a weekend in Fort Benning, Georgia.
Yeah, before his permanent assignment to Fort Hood, Texas, as a radio repairman.
Now, let me tell you what happened to me in Fort Hood.
All right.
Well, go ahead on with the story. It's not a great one.
Have you been to Fort Hood? Okay. Have you actually been to Fort Hood?
I've been to Fort Hood, yeah.
Okay. Well, Dean reportedly hated the military service. He'd been in the military. Applied for a hardship discharge on the grounds that he was needed for the family business. Plus, he had the, you know, he had the heart ailment. So he was given an honorable military discharge on June 11, 1965, after 10 months of service. So he served his country for 10 months. Brandy?
What?
Thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you for your service.
I don't know that 10 months warrants a thank you.
Yeah.
Evidently 3 months does.
Yes.
Well, 3 months warrants a pension and all kinds of shit.
All right. So following his honorable discharge from the Army, Correll returned to Houston and returned to the position he held as vice president of the family's candy business. So he's back as VP of the Pop-Tarts, Sweet Tarts. In 1965, shortly after he completed
his... Pecan Prince.
Yeah. So in 1965, shortly after he completed his military service, the Correll Candy Company, as it is now known... moved across the street from a...
So it was a big move.
Yeah, it moved across the street from an elementary school.
Oh!
Pretty good thinking here.
Not even have to buy a van. He did not have to get a white panel.
He was known to give free candy away to local children, and particularly teenage boys, for some reason. He seemed to have a fondness for teenage boys. The family company was also employed a small workforce, and he was seemed to behave flirtatiously toward several teenage male employees. He even installed a pool table at the rear of the factory where the youth could play pool and he could interact with them.
So he was putting lots of things in the rear.
Yeah, 1967.
Probably gave him candy.
In 1967, he befriended David Brooks, who was 12 years old, and this guy becomes accomplice later.
Integral
on.
To the story.
Yeah, he does. He was in the sixth grade then. He was 12 years old and was one of the many children that Dean gave free candy to. He also gave him money later on. We'll get into that. But Brooks initially became one of Correll's more many youthful close companions. He was older, but he was hanging around with these teenage boys. It was unseemly, Colonel.
That is unseemly.
You should stop doing it.
Do you think... See, it's people like Dean Correll that are causing this whole bathroom problem.
I'm not sure about that.
They go around with candy and... I don't understand it.
I've never seen anybody walk with candy in the bathroom. I've never seen anybody walk into the bathroom with candy.
You know, just the other day, a woman came into the men's bathroom with some Pop-Tarts in her hand.
Bitch.
So he also took the young guys to the beaches in South Texas.
They're lovely.
And took them on motorcycle rides.
Galveston, Galveston.
And even allowed, no singing, Colonel. Brooks, barely.
For now.
Yeah, until this podcast. he was allowed to ride, he let Brooks ride the motorcycle himself. So he would give Brooks money and gifts. Brooks' parents were divorced. His father lived in Houston. His mother had relocated to Beaumont, a city about 85 miles east of Houston.
They are allowed to dance there.
Beaumont?
Yeah.
They were allowed to dance there, weren't they?
Yeah, Beaumont was a place
that's where they had the grain store that Wren worked at.
So Beaumont was progressive.
Beaumont is more progressive than the other place in Footloose.
In 1970, of course, Colonel, you were probably 25 years old by that point.
I was 7 years old, Timmy.
I wasn't born.
In 1970, when Brooks was 15, he dropped out of high school and moved to Beaumont to live with his mother. Whenever he visited his father in Houston, though, he would visit Correll, who allowed him to stay at his apartment if he wished to do so. So it was unseemly. Upon Correll's urging, a sexual relationship gradually developed between the two. What do you think about that, Colonel?
Well, I guess when he got that feeling, he needed sexual healing, Timmy.
Dean paid Brooks to allow him to form fellatio on the youth, and the same year he moved back to Houston.
Hold on.
Yeah, he paid him to allow... Dean paid Brooks money so
he could give him a blowjob.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to try that one at home. Look here, Mrs. Colonel, before you try that, I'm going to need a 20.
That's fucked up.
That goes over. Yeah.
That's fucked up.
By the time Brooks dropped out of high school, Carell's mother and half-sister Joyce had moved to Colorado. So he's living in Houston all by himself now with the candy store in 1968. Although she often talked to her oldest son on telephone, she never would see him again.
She was probably avoiding him because he is creepy.
Afterwards, she... protested his
protested.
She protested,
my boy is innocent.
Yeah, but then later on she said that she thought that he probably was responsible for even more murders than it is known. But anyway, following the closure of the candy company, they had a little recession there in the late 60s, and candy was, candy company went under.
It was a good run while it lasted.
Yeah. No more Milk Duds. He took a job as an electrician at the Houston Lighting and Power Company, where he tested electrical relay systems. But he's still living in Houston. He's got all of his little friends around. And what happens next, Brandy?
From 1970 to 1973, Carell killed at least 28 people.
Wow, he was busy.
Well.
For how long? How long did he do this?
3 years.
3 years?
Yes.
Yeah, it was in a short span of time. Yeah.
In 3 years, I ain't done 28 days work here at the place.
Yeah. All of his victims were males aged 13 to 20. The majority were in their mid-teens.
Yeah, he was a sick bastard. He doesn't get the publicity that John Wayne Gacy gets, but he seems... What are you doing there, Colonel?
My water bottle broke on me.
I have an idea.
Yeah, he seemed to be sucking on that thing pretty hard.
Suck a golf ball through a garden hose, he can.
All right, what happened to him?
The chrome off a trailer hitch. That's what it was. All right. Most of his victims were abducted from Houston Heights. That was a low-income neighborhood. It was northwest of downtown Houston. So you're familiar with northwest of downtown Houston, right?
Yeah. It's the opposite of southeast.
Yeah. It is. So with most of his abductions, he was assisted by one or both of his teenage accomplices, Elmer Wayne Henley, clearly three names.
Yeah.
And David Owen Brooks.
Yeah,
again,
three names.
Mm-hmm. Several victims were friends of one or the other of his accomplices, and two other victims, Billy Balch and Mally Winkle, which those are stupid names, were former employees of the Carell Candy Company.
Yeah, so when the candy company went under, those poor 12-year-olds were thrown out of work.
Mm-hmm.
When they should have gone to the coal mine.
They were dislocated. Yeah,
they should have gone to the coal mine.
Business going under, time for you to go down.
Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
Well, and they also could have gotten blowjobs for money. So clearly they were not entrepreneurial. So, let's see. Carell's victims were typically lured into his windowless panel van with an offer of a party or a lift. And then they were driven to his house. And I'm sure he plied them with candy. They were either plied with alcohol or drugs until they passed out. Mm-hmm. They were tricked into putting on handcuffs.
Yeah. Gacy did that too. Or it's amazing the number of people that slip on.
Well,
candy.
I'm sorry.
They go to that serial killer. They take that correspondence.
The serial killer academy.
Yeah, that's correspondence course.
SKA.
SKA.
Graduated from SCA.
Or they were simply grabbed by force. So they pulled
whatever
up,
works.
Open
whatever
the van, works. Open the van door, pull them in,
well,
gone.
Sometimes you have to do that, but it's better if you can offer them candy and do the handcuff trick.
Well, yeah. Let's see. Then they were stripped naked.
Naked?
Naked, and tied to either Carell's bed or usually a plywood torture board, where they were sexually assaulted, tortured, and sometimes after several days... killed by strangulation, or they shot him with a .22 caliber pistol. Their bodies were tied in plastic sheeting and buried in any one of four places. They'd rented a boat shed. Mm-hmm. There was a beach on, was it Bolivar Peninsula?
Mm-hmm.
A woodland near Lake Sam Rayburn.
Yeah, he was a congressman.
Yeah.
They named the lake after him.
And, well, his family owned Lakeside Cabin. And then there was Corral's family. Mm-hmm. And then there was a beach in nearby Jefferson County, which, of course, you're familiar with.
I know Jefferson County, yeah.
In several instances, Corral forced his victims to phone or write their parents with explanations for their absences in an effort to, you know, quell the parents' fears for their son's safety.
Hey, Mom, won't be home for dinner.
Yeah.
Don't wait up.
He also was known to keepsakes, usually keys, from his victims.
I wonder if he's ever stored Pop-Tarts.
Fuckers. During the years in which he abducted and murdered young men, Corral often changed addresses. However, until he moved to Pasadena in the spring of 73, he always lived in or close to Houston Heights.
It's a poor neighborhood where kids can be easily abducted and not go, you know,
right.
be missed.
So he killed his first victim. It was an 18-year-old college freshman named Jeffrey Conan on September 25th of 1970. Conan vanished while hitchhiking with another student from the University of Texas to his parents' home in Houston.
The Longhorns.
He was dropped off alone at the corner of Westheimer Road and South Voss Road near the uptown area of Houston, which, of course,
is the opposite of downtown.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, you can take one of three routes from downtown to that location.
Yes.
But the interstate, or you can go through town, or you can take the bypass.
Well, but this was at the corner of Westheimer Road and South Voss Road.
Which Chuck is very familiar. Mm-hmm.
He knows that corner well.
Yeah.
So.
You used to play on that corner, a stickball on that corner.
Mm-hmm. Used to hang out and sing a cappella on that corner. Yeah.
You used to wave your wiener at people as they drove by and ask for money, didn't you? All right, so Corral likely offered to drive Conan to his parents' home. And Conan eventually accepted the lift from him, clearly. David Brooks led police to Jeffrey's body on August 10th of 1973. So 3 years later, this turncoat, you know, mm-hmm. leads police right there. Yeah, well, I always knew it was you, Fredo. That body was buried at High Island Beach.
Okay.
Which was not mentioned as one of the four places that they likely buried people.
Apparently there's five.
Apparently there is five. So.
Don't believe what you read.
Yeah. Forensic science.
Did you get this shit off the internet?
No. Actually, I flew down to Houston at the court records.
Forensic scientists subsequently deduced that the youth had died from asphyxiation caused by manual strangulation.
And that means it stops you from breathing.
Well, and manual strangulation means it's done with your hands.
Yes.
Thank you for that.
No, it's not necessarily true.
Can you commit suicide by manual strangulation?
That's called
erotic asphyxiation.
But that's with a rope. I mean, actually grabbing yourself and choking yourself to death.
No, because you pass out eventually, and then you can breathe again.
Hey, you know what? I got a niece. She's crazier than hell.
No.
When she'd get mad, she'd be a little kid. No, she would throw a fit and hold her breath till she passed out.
That's awesome.
Nope. Here's the beauty of this.
She's slow now.
She got a little 1-year-old boy, not even 1-year-old, 6-month-old boy, Jackson. Yeah. My great nephew, wonderful boy. And that little son of a bitch get mad, he hold his breath till he passes out.
Good God.
It must be a genetic thing.
Yeah. So you can't strangle yourself to death by your hands.
No. With your own hands you can't, no.
We need to try that, Colonel. You could be the first.
Go team. So he also had a cloth gag placed in his mouth.
Stop it, Colonel.
The body was found buried underneath a layer of lime. When are you going to pass out? Because I'm going to wait for that.
You can't do it. I tried. I gave it a shot for you, Timmy.
Thank you, Colonel.
All right. So the body was found buried beneath a layer of lime. It was wrapped in plastic. He was naked and bound hand and foot, suggesting that he had also been violated.
Oh, you mean sexually violated?
I think that's what you mean here, yes. My guess is yes, that's what you mean.
All right.
Around the time of Conan's murder, David Brooke interrupted Coral in the act of assaulting two teenage boys whom he'd strapped to a plywood torture board.
Yeah, this torture board thing was creepy.
Well, Coral promised Brooks a car in return for his silence, so clearly you're quiet at that point because you want a car.
This man was what we would call in the business a sexual sadist.
A predator? What business is that, Colonel? What business would you call him?
The criminologist business.
It's a business that you're not in.
Myself and Allie, we would call him a sexual sadist.
You can't call him anything.
Try choking yourself, Colonel.
He enjoyed... Hold on. I tried it before, but it just...
Here, let me try and choke you, and let's see if I can do it.
Okay, Brandy, continue.
Okay, but anyway, no.
Sexual sadist.
He was
sexual
talking.
Sexual sadist, and he had the torture board.
Yeah.
So he could inflict pain upon these poor children. As he,
what?
Because it's the only way he could get sexual gratification is if they were in pain.
Well, thanks for that insight, Dr. Phil. No shit.
Well, I don't know if you know.
Christ.
He was trying to break it down so you could understand it.
I just want you to get a better feel for who this man was.
You know, that's like Timmy doing a recap after every fucking sentence. I think we got it. All right. So he promised him a car.
Right. This is Brooks.
Yes, Carell promised Brooks a car. Mm-hmm. Brooks accepted the offer, and Carell bought him a Chevy Corvette.
Holy shit! How many times you got to take it in the back end to get a?
Well, no, he was just quiet about him torturing those kids.
And he agreed to procure more kids for him. So, but he must have some.
I got to get to that.
He must have some money though to be able to go.
Well, he owned a candy shop.
Yeah, well, it went under. Sales were flat for Tootsie Rolls, apparently.
Apparently. Brooks was later told by Carell that the two youths had been murdered, but he offered Brooks $200 for any boy that he could lure to Carell's apartment.
See, you know what I don't get about this story? Is okay, I can see you have one sick motherfucker who goes
around. There's three of them here.
I know. How do they all come
together? I think they're all touched. I don't think it's anything. I think they're all touched.
I mean, how do they meet up? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
How do they all...
I know. But I think they're together. I think they're all touched. Yeah. I think you've just got one that's less touched than the other ones, and he just leads them around.
I guess.
So, let's see. On December 15th, 1970, which was 10 days before Christmas...
Yes, and that was... 1970, that was... Colonel was 23.
Yes.
I was seven years old.
And Carell got an early birthday present when David Brooks lured two 14-year-old boys named James.
It was really an early Christmas present.
Or early Christmas, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Named James.
Well, it was both because his birthday's on December 24th.
Well, fuck.
It'd be and
it's
or.
A twofer.
It's and or.
It's a twofer.
Because, you know, he had the problem of having his birthday right before Christmas.
I hate that shit. I always thought that would be the neatest thing because you get double birthday presents, but you don't.
No.
You don't know.
They never even announced.
No, it's great.
You get the same number of presents, half of them are for your birthday. I paid $4 for this thing.
Why are you putting your fingers
in the water jug? I always get screwed on Mother's Day because my birthday's right around Mother's Day.
Yeah.
And so it's always, well, here, you know, I got you this for, you know, birthday / Mother's Day. Well, no, motherfucker, that's two different presents that you need to be getting me. That's okay.
I'm going to get you some Pop-Tarts.
I would appreciate that. So anyway, so for Christmas / birthday, whatever. David Brooks brought in James Glass and Danny Yates. He took them away from a religious rally that was held near Houston Heights to Carell's Yorktown apartment. So clearly, they did not all get into the rally.
That day did not go as planned, obviously.
Glass was an acquaintance of Brooks who, at Brooks' behest, had previously visited Carell's apartment, so I would think he'd know what he was getting into.
Yeah, when you see that torture table.
It's a giveaway.
Yeah.
Have you seen the torture table on there? It's a spooky looking thing.
Yeah, that's what I said. It's creepy.
But this guy went back. He'd been there one time, and now this dumb sumbitch is going back.
Maybe he thought he changed.
You suck one dick, and you're just going to keep on keeping on, aren't you? Crime in Italy. All right, so... both youths were tied to the opposite sides of Carell's torture board and subsequently raped, strangled, and buried in a boat shed Carell had rented.
So one is on each side of the board.
Yes, that would be strapped to opposite sides. Thanks for clearing that up for our listeners.
Well, they'd be back to back.
It's like victim roulette. You just spin the board.
No, but, you know, I think the bottom one would get squished when you're doing
stuff.
No,
it was...
No,
it was elevated.
It was stood up straight. Yeah. The board was stood up straight.
Yeah, so like, oh, I don't like any part of that. Okay.
Yeah. He could move the board.
Yeah. And they could lay it parallel, I guess.
He did actually on his last ones lay it down.
But. Yeah, with the girl.
So 6 weeks after the double murder of Glass and Yates on January 30th, 1971, Happy New Year, Brooks and Krell encountered two teenage brothers named Donald and Jerry Waldrop walking to a bowling alley. Both boys were enticed into Carell's van. He must have a bunch of puppies. And were driven to an apartment that Carell had moved into on Magnum Road, which clearly you're familiar with.
Oh, yeah, Magnum.
Yeah, where they were little bitty Magnums.
That's why I go get my condoms.
Bitty Magnum, Magnum Road. At the bitty Magnum.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Store, where they were raped, tortured, and strangled before Brooks and Carell buried them in the boat shed. Boat shed's getting a lot of action here.
Mm-hmm.
Between March and May of 1971, which is right around Tim's birthday, he was 25, Carell killed...
No, I was only 11.
Carell killed 10. Three more boys between the ages of 13 and 16. As with the Waldrop brothers, all lived in Houston Heights.
Yeah, all from poor neighborhoods.
Two of these victims, David Hillegeist and Mally Winkle, were abducted and killed together on the afternoon of May 29th, 1971. As had been the case with parents of the other victims of Carell, both sets of parents launched a frantic search for their sons. One of the Utes, who voluntarily offered to distribute posters the parents had printed offering a reward for information, was 15-year-old Elmer Wayne Hensley, a lifelong friend of Hillegeist. The youth pinned the posters around the Heights and attempted to reassure Hillegeist's mother that there may be an innocent explanation for the boy's absence. On August 17th, 1971, Carell and Brooks encountered a 17-year-old acquaintance of Brooks named Reuben Watson walking home from a movie theater in Houston. Brooks persuaded Watson to attend a party at Carell's address. Party in quotation marks.
Yeah.
The youth agreed and was taken to Carell's home, where he was subsequently strangled and buried in the boat shed.
That's not much of a party.
Seems like a bummer.
I hope they ought to have some good hors d'oeuvres there, because if you're going to rape me and strangle me, at least give me some
shrimp cocktails. At least have some crack puffs.
Well, they should have some crack puffs. They have little party hats.
Those little tiny sandwiches? Give me a couple little tiny
finger sandwiches.
Yeah.
All right. In the winter of 1971, Brooks introduced Elmer Wayne Hensley to Dean Carell. Yeah. Oh, it's Henley. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Henley may have been lured to Carell's address as an intended victim. However, Carell eventually decided that Henley would make a good accomplice and offered him the same fee.
He had an eye for talent. Instead of killing you, I'm going to hire you.
Back before Donald Trump did The Apprentice, there was Dean Carell.
Yeah.
All right, so same deal. $200 for any boy who could get to the apartment.
Now, see, that created a little competition between Brooks and Henley.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And you
know what? That's probably written down somewhere on here, but you fucking killed it. So.
But, you know, this is why I don't believe that capitalism really works all that effectively. Because eventually they would have got each other down to, like, okay, $25 a victim.
Yeah.
But see, they had a monopoly. That's why they had to break up.
You just bring more and more and more.
Yeah, there's an unlimited supply.
So they was price fixing.
Yeah, they really were.
They were price fixing.
All right.
It was a monopoly.
Okay. So he informed Henley that he
Carell. Colluding.
They were colluding.
Yeah.
Carell informed Henley that he was involved in a sexual slavery ring operating from Dallas.
Well, he was true. He was telling the truth. It was a sexual slavery ring, but it was
around his apartment.
Yeah.
It was at his house.
Henley accepted Carell's offer and initially participated in the abduction of victims. But then later, he actively participated in many of the killings.
Yeah, Henley really got into it, whereas
according to Henley,
was less active.
Yeah, I think they're all slow.
Well, yeah, they're all guilty, but I'm just saying Henley became more sadistic. He became more like Carell.
According to Henley, the first abduction he participated in occurred at 925 Schuller Street.
Schuller Street.
925. Can you look it up on Google Maps?
Yeah.
Let's check that out. An address that Carell had moved to in February of 1972. Although Brooks later claimed that Henley became involved in the abductions of victims while Carell resided at an address he occupied prior to Schuller. Who gives a shit? If Henley's statement...
I'm nothing if I'm not detailed.
God, yeah. If Henley's statement is to be believed, the victim was abducted from the Heights in February or early March of 1972.
Our readers can go on Google Map and look up the location.
Our readers? I mean, we don't have readers.
Our listeners. They can go into Google Maps, look it up, look at the location, and get a good feel for where these events took place. I'm thinking of the listener here when I'm writing. I'm not thinking of you.
Apparently you ain't. I got like 13 pages over here. Yeah,
and apparently you don't give a shit about our listeners because you keep giving Chuck all this information. In the statement Henley gave to police following his arrest, the Ute stated that he and Carell picked up a youth at the corner of 11th and Stewood. Again.
11th and Stewood?
That's
a busy intersection. How are you going to grab
it? Right down the street from 12th and Stewart.
Yes. And they
That's
lured
a busy street. How are you going to do that?
Well, they lured him to Carell's
home intersection
on the promise of smoking some of the weed.
Not the devil's. See, kids, now listen here.
Ganja.
Listen here. Somebody approach you and say, I got some of the devil's lettuce.
I want to smoke some weed.
I want to smoke some reefer with you. Haven't you seen the show Reefer Madness? What you're going to get is sodomized, strangulated, and buried in a boathouse.
You should never go anywhere with anybody in a panel van.
Not really.
As a rule of thumb, stay away from panel vans.
Right. Yeah.
But if you're going to get in the panel van, you got to admit, someone offering you weed is probably, it's about the best deal you're
going to
get.
Well, then you're in the mystery machine. Then you're going to solve mysteries, and that's okay.
Yeah.
So, Henley duped the youth into donning a pair of...
Duped him!
Yeah. Oh, that
you're like my
son of a bitch.
You like my turn of phrase.
Your turn of phrase. He duped him into donning a pair of handcuffs.
Donning
like reading
even.
Shakespeare.
Thank you.
Before leaving him alone with Carell.
What handcuffs dost thee don?
Evidently, this is some shit. I bet they're not the fuzzy kind either.
I bet they were serious. There was a hard nickel-plated kind.
Yeah. The identity of this victim is not conclusively known. What?
He must have tortured the shit out of him.
Although it's possible that the Ute was Willard Branch, a 17-year-old casual acquaintance of Henley and Brooks, who disappeared on February 9th of 1972 and was buried where? Anyone?
In the boathouse.
In the boat shed. There we go.
Did they even have a fucking boat in there?
I don't think so. I think it was just like a hangout spot.
That's some bitch. That boat, they must have called it the SS Minnow, because when you got on it, you just disappeared
forever.
It was
more of a canoe.
Okay. It was a blow-up raft. Yeah.
It was just more one of those little rings, those little plastic rings that they kept in there.
A life jacket.
Yeah. 1 month later, on March 24th, 1972, Henley, Brooks, and Carell encountered an 18-year-old acquaintance of Henley's. These motherfuckers know everybody. An 18-year-old acquaintance of Henley's named Frank Anthony Augier.
Well, come on, you're offering a 17, 18-year-old boy's weed. You're going to get a lot of...
Oh, they're going to skip into the van.
Yeah.
You need me to put on handcuffs for this shit? All right. Yeah.
That's what I mean.
I'll give you a bag of Doritos if you do that.
Easy pickings.
All right, so this poor guy was leaving a restaurant on Yale Street where he worked. Henley called Augier over to Carell's van. And invited the youth to Carell's apartment on the promise that he could drink beer and smoke marijuana with the trio.
Oh, the devil's lettuce again.
Yeah, and the devil's brew.
Augier agreed and followed the pair to Carell's home in his Rambler.
Oh, I love the Rambler.
He's a Rambler man.
Made a lot
Lord, he was born a Rambler man. Inside Carell's house,
Agar was given marijuana. Jesus Christ. And then tricked into donning a pair of handcuffs. I want to know what the trick is here.
Okay. Put your hands out.
I'm gonna teach you a trick. Close your eyes. Put your hands out. But it sounds like, when you say that he was tricked into donning, it sounds like they put him on it. He put him on himself, is what
that's,
it sounds
yeah,
like.
Yeah, that's what they did.
That's what it sounds
just
like.
Put him on.
Yeah,
see,
but,
what, put these
them,
on and you can have pot. But we just want to make sure you don't hurt yourself.
Yeah, not in all of them. Some of them, the boys had passed out, and then they woke up with handcuffs on.
They
woke up with more than handcuffs on.
So he was tricked into donning a pair of handcuffs before Correll pounced on the youth.
Am I using the word donning a bit too much?
Yes. Henry, I'm going to change it up when I see it again.
Any thesaurus.
Henry left Agar alone with Correll. Henry later claimed to have discovered Correll torturing the youth, upon which Correll informed him that he had raped, tortured, and killed the previous victim he had assisted in abducting, and that he had intended to do the same with this kid. Henley was again paid for luring the victim to Correll's home and subsequently assisted Correll and Brooks in Augier's burial at High Island Beach. Despite the revelations that Correll was, in reality, killing the boys whom him and Brooks had assisted in abducting.
Well, the guy's a real cockwomble. I just want to say that.
Oh, good, good. Yes.
He had a thing for a teenage boy cockwomble.
He did.
Mutant Ninja Turtles. Sorry, you guys could have filled in that silence while I was drinking, because...
I'm sorry.
My throat got dry, but that's all right. I'm good.
He enrobed them into handcuffs.
Okay.
What?
No,
enrobed.
It's too late now. I've had my drink. The silence is over.
Put on, wear, dress. I'm giving the synonyms for...
So Henley became an active participant in the abduction and the murders. Within a month, on April 20th, 1972, he assisted Correll in the abduction of another Ute, a 17-year-old friend of his named Mark Scott. Finally a normal name.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Scott was grabbed by force and fought furiously against attempts by Correll to secure him to the torture board, even attempting to stab his
attackers.
Scott,
we don't give the ass up easy.
No, we do not. However, Scott saw Henley point a gun toward him, and according to Brooks...
Then we give up the ass.
Mark just gave up.
Yeah. You show us a gun, we're spreading.
Scott was tied to the torture board and suffered the same fate as Augier: rape, torture, strangulation, and buried at High Island Beach. According to Brooks, Henley was especially sadistic with his participation in the murders committed at 925 Schuller. Before Correll vacated the address on June 26th, Henry assisted Correll and Brooks in the abduction and murder of two Utes named Billy Balch and Johnny DeLone. In Brooks' confession, he stated that both youths were tied to Correll's bed, and after their torture and rape, Henley manually strangled Balch, then shouted, "Hey, Johnny," and shot DeLone in the forehead with the bullet exiting through the youth's ear. DeLone then pleaded with Henley, "Wayne, please don't," before he too was strangled.
Yeah, Henley was a real cockwomble.
During the time Correll lived at Schuller, the trio lured a 17-year-old youth named Billy Rittinger to the house. Rittinger was tied to the plywood board, tortured and abused by Correll. Brooks later claimed he persuaded Correll to allow Rittinger to be released, and the youth was allowed to leave the residence. On another occasion at Schuller, Henley knocked Brooks unconscious as he left, as he entered the home. Correll then tied Brooks to his bed and assaulted the youth repeatedly before releasing him.
Yeah, so even Brooks is getting abused by them.
Despite the assault, Brooks continued to assist Correll in... Well, $200 is $200.
It's his job. I mean, it's his job. Plus, he had an obligation because of the car.
That's true. Let's see.
He got a Corvette. He didn't get a Rambler.
After vacating the Schuller residence, Correll moved into an apartment at Westcott Towers, where he is known to have killed a further four victims. The first victim was Stephen Sickman. He was killed on July 20th. Two further boys were abducted and murdered on October 3rd, and a 19-year-old youth named Richard Kepner was murdered on November 12th.
Every month or two.
Altogether, a minimum of 9 teenagers between the ages of 13 and 19 were murdered between February and November of 1972. 5 of whom were buried at High Island Beach, and 4 inside where?
The boathouse.
The boathouse.
It's a shed. It's more of a shed.
All right. Mm-hmm.
On January 20th,
19... I'm very humble. I come from very humble beginnings. It's a house to me.
Oh, okay. Well, on January 20th, 1973, Correll moved to the address on Wirt Road in the Spring Branch District of Houston. Within 2 weeks of moving into the address, he had killed a 17-year-old youth named Joseph Lyles, before vacating the apartment and moving to 2020 Lamar Drive in Pasadena on March 7th. No known victims were killed from February to June 3rd of 1973. Well, clearly because he didn't have his helpers with him.
And I think he was ill during that time. Correll had some sort of ear infection.
Yeah, although he was known to have suffered from hydrocephaly? Is that what you were trying to say?
He was a big old waterhead boy.
Hydrocephaly?
Well,
hydrocephaly.
No, that's not what it says here. I had to make up the word.
You got the big head.
Yeah. Yeah, well, here's the thing.
Hydrocephaly. What would you say that is?
Hydrocephaly. You break in my heart.
Okay.
Don't sing.
Oh, Paul Simon got me
dead. Which may account for the sudden lull in killings.
Yeah, he had some health
issues.
He had some health issues.
Yes.
It could
have been made more clear by our producer, although I don't think he knew how to spell it, and so he just put down whatever kind of words he could find. Between June 4th and July 7th, 1973, a further three victims were murdered and buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. And on July 12th, a 17-year-old youth named John Sellers was murdered and buried at High Island Beach. Why? He was out in Pasadena.
He was. They had four locations.
Or did they come back? Did he come back and murder them?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. In July of 1973, David Brooks married his pregnant fiance. Aw.
Yeah.
And Henley temporarily. Mazel tov, yes. Henley temporarily became Correll's sole procurer of victims.
So now, Colonel, he's the only man. He's the only business in town.
Yeah.
According to Henley, these three abductions.
He cornered the market.
He did have it. He was a monopoly.
Yeah.
According to Henley, these three abductions were the only three that occurred after his becoming accomplice to Correll, in which David Brooks was not a participant. One of these three victims was buried at Lake Sam Rayburn, and the other two that were abducted together on July 25th were buried
at the boathouse.
Yeah, at the boathouse.
On August 3rd, 1973, Correll killed his last victim, a 13-year-old boy from South Houston named James Dremala. Dremala was abducted while riding his bike in Pasadena and driven to Correll's home, where he was tied to Correll's torture board, raped and strangled with a cord before being buried in the
boathouse.
David Brooks later described Dremala as a small blonde boy whom he'd bought pizza before the youth was attacked.
Yeah, pizza and marijuana.
So that was his last victim.
Now, what we normally talk about is the arrest, apprehension, and trial and conviction. But this story has a twist. So tell us about the twist, Colonel.
Well, the twist is that, you know, Benjamin Franklin said you could keep a secret with three people if he killed two of them.
Right.
He was so wise.
And that's where he came into it.
Yeah.
Now, on the evening of August 7th.
Benjamin Franklin used to get a lot of tail.
He got the syphilis, too, Timmy.
Yeah, but he got a lot. Well, you know, that's the price of doing business.
Yeah, but he got the syphilis and the gonorrhea.
Mm.
So anyway, in the year of our Lord, 1973, Henley, age 17, invited a 19-year-old youth named Timothy Cordell to attend Timothy Cordell Curley.
Mm-hmm.
To attend a party at Correll's Pasadena home.
Boy, there's a lot of partying going on there.
Oh,
party central.
It was party central. So anyway, Curley, who was intended to be Correll's next victim, he accepted the offer. David Brooks was nowhere to be found at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the two youths arrived at the house, sniffed some paint fumes, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
We all want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Drank some alcohol until midnight before leaving the house to purchase...
Purchase what?
Sandwiches.
Okay.
They wanted to buy some sandwiches.
Didn't they want to go to Jack in the Box?
Were they loose meat sandwiches? I don't understand.
They just needed a sandwich.
Okay.
Okay.
Sometimes you need a sandwich.
Yeah, I mean, well, have you ever sniffed paint fumes?
Yeah, well.
It gives you the munchies. Yeah. It gives you a wicked ass headache, but it gives you the munchies.
Also eat your brain, but.
Well,
you become addicted. You have to watch sniffing paint.
You can become addicted.
You become an idiot.
We're worried right now about Should we have the intervention now on the air?
Here's the thing. You keep sniffing paint. You know what happens? Time you're middle-aged, you're sitting around doing podcasts.
That's what that. You know what we used to do?
You're writing this shit. I can tell you that.
We used to, and this is a true story, we used to take Pam.
Yeah.
You know that spray on Pam?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Spray it into plastic baggies and inhale it.
Huff it.
Yeah. We did that shit all the time.
That's not good for your brain.
I turned out fine. Anyway, they went to get the sandwiches.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Henley and Curly.
If they got salami on rye.
They was about to get the corned beef.
I thought they got the footlong.
The pastrami footlong.
All right.
So anyway, Henley and Curly drove back to Houston Heights, and Curly parked his vehicle close to Henley's home.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where it gets tricky, Timmy.
It's very clever of him to do that.
Henley exits the vehicle and walks toward the home of 15-year-old Rhonda Williams, who had been beaten by her drunken father that evening.
Yeah, this poor kid. It's the first female that comes along in this story.
Yeah. And she decided to temporarily leave home until her drunken father became her sober father.
Right. It's sort of like Forrest Gump when Jenny got beat up by her dad and they wanted to pretend that they were birds and they could fly far, far away.
Yeah.
So
Henley invites Rhonda over.
A little different.
To spend the evening at Coral's home.
Okay.
Rhonda says okay, and she climbs in the back of Curly's Volkswagen. They make it to Coral's Pasadena residence. Now at about 3 a.m. they get there.
Okay.
Henley and Curly. At night, 3 a.m., yeah. Henry and Curly arrived back at Curl's home, accompanied by Rhonda Williams. Now, Curl is, he just damn furious.
He did not want the young teenage girl around.
He pulled him aside and he said, "What I tell you, bros before hoes."
Yes.
I don't know if he said
that. She does not have a penis.
He said, "Titties ruin everything."
Tell me about it.
And, So he met. But Henley explained to Williams that arguing with her father that evening did not wish to return home.
He wanted a sausage fest.
So Coral, he seemed to calm down, offered the three teenagers some beer and some marijuana.
Man.
They start drinking, smoking the devil's lettuce.
Yeah.
The ganja.
Yeah.
And drinking beer and watching them. And Coral, he just watching them. Mm-hmm. After about 2 hours of drinking and smoking, these lightweights, Henry, Curly, and Williams, each pass out. Of course, it's 5 a.m.
Right.
Now, Henley awoke to find Curl snapping handcuffs onto his wrists.
Now, Henley, the one who was his partner there
previously,
now he's getting handcuffed.
He's getting handcuffed to the torture board.
Mm-hmm.
His ankles have been bound together, and
you know, if I was Henley, I'd have a hard time falling asleep in that place.
I wouldn't. I would sleep with one eye open
and
a cork in my ass, but Curly and Williams lay beside Henley. They were both secured and bound with nylon rope and gagged with adhesive tape and laying face down on the floor. Curly had been stripped naked.
What about Mo?
Now, Curl told Henley that he was so damn pissed that he brought a girl to the house and explained that he was going to kill all three of them after, of course, he sodomized and tortured Curly. Now, he repeatedly kicked Williams in the stomach, the poor girl, and in the chest, then dragged Henley into the kitchen, placed a .22 caliber pistol against his stomach, threatening to shoot him. Henley calmed down Curl. He says, I'll participate in this. I'll kill them all with you. Just don't shoot me in the stomach with that thing.
Yeah. A reasonable request.
Yeah, Curl agreed. He unties Henley. He carries Curly and Williams into his bedroom, ties them to opposite sides of the torture board. Curly on his stomach, Williams on her back. He handed Henley a hunting knife and ordered him to cut away Williams' clothes, insisting that while he would rape and kill Curly, Henry was to rape and kill Williams. Now, Henley began.
He didn't want nothing to do with the Poo-Tang.
There's a lot of raping and killing going on.
Oh, this is like a hobo convention.
Yes.
So anyway, Henley began cutting away Williams' clothes as Curl undressed and began to assault and torture Curly.
Right, Curly being the boy.
Now both Williams and Curly had awakened by this point. Now Curly wake up. Now I want you to think about this.
Mm-hmm.
Curly wake up writhing,
mm-hmm. Tied to the board.
Yeah, tied to the board and shouting as Williams, who's gagged Henry, removed, lifted ahead, asked Henley, is this for real? Which Henley answered, oh, yeah, it's for real. And then Williams asked Henley, are you going to do anything about it? So Henley says, well, let me take Rhonda into another room. Now, Crowell ignores him.
He was a little sweet on her, I think.
Yeah, and he ignores her, ignores the question, because he is just, and delicate listeners, forgive me here, but Timmy can put things crudely here, but he just pounding away at poor Curly. Curly just taking a pounding. So he all wrapped up in that. He ain't paying no attention.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, Correll, he ignored Henley, and Correll ignored him. Mm-hmm. And Henley then grabbed Correll's pistol, shouting, you've gone far enough, Dean. To which Dean said, no, I got a good 2-3 inches I can still go.
He did not say that.
Okay. God.
But anyway, Henley pulls a gun.
Now, Henley got the gun pointed at Correll.
Mm-hmm.
Correll pulls out, approaches Henley with his little tiny wiener standing in attention, and says, oh, yeah, kill me, Wayne. Now, Henley stepped back a few paces, and Correll keep walking at him. Correll just look at him and says, you won't do it. Henry fired at Correll, hit him right in the damn forehead.
I like it.
But
so
Correll,
apparently he miscalculated that.
Correll, being Michael Myers of rapists and sodomizers, continued to lurch toward him.
Oh, Jesus, now he's a fucking zombie.
Yeah, now Henley fired another further.
He's Rasputin now.
Two more rounds at him, hitting him in the left shoulder. Correll spun around, staggered out of the room, hitting the hallway. Henley fired 3 additional bullets into his lower back and shoulders. Correll slid down the wall in the hallway outside the room where the 2 teenagers were bound. Correll died where he fell, his naked body lying face towards the wall. And after the shooting, Henley cut Curly loose, and Williams, they got him from the torture board, and all 3 dressed and discussed what they was going to do. The first thing Curly said was, go to the refrigerator, get me some ice. I got to sit down on it for a while. That
he
was no fun.
He did not say that,
though.
Concerned about the bloody stool.
Good
Lord.
He complained. He was going to have the bloody stool for quite some time after that action, I suppose. But Henley said, let's just let it get, let's get the hell out of here. And Curly's like, oh, no, we got to call the police. So Henley, being the dumb fuck that he was, agreed, looked up the number for the Pasadena Police Department, and called them. At 8:24, now remember, this has gone on all night.
All night.
His call was answered by, and believe it or not, Timmy put the operator, and I'm the,
it was in the
police operator's name down here. I don't know what.
I know. Her name so was in the report. That's
Henley blurts out to the operator, y'all better come here right now. I just killed a man.
Oh, goodness.
Because he was from Texas. He had that funny accent. Y'all better come here right now. I just killed a man. So Henley, he gives the address to the operator, as, you know, the address that he lived in. And so as Curly and Williams and Henley, they're waiting on Correll's porch for the police to arrive. Henley mentioned to Curly that he had done that, killed by shooting other people 4 or 5 times. A few minutes later, the police get there. The 3 teenagers are all sitting there. And the officer notes that they got a .22 caliber pistol in the driveway. Henley informed the officers that the individual who made the call and indicated that Curl was lying dead inside the house.
Jeez.
After confiscating the pistol and placing Henley, Williams, and Curly inside the patrol car, the officer entered the bungalow and discovered Curl's body dead inside the hallway. The officer returned to his car, read Henley his Miranda rights. In response, Henley shouted, I don't care who knows about it. I have to get it off my chest, you cowardly bastard. Couldn't even keep his mouth, but anyway. Curly later informed detectives that before a police officer arrived there, Henley informed him, I could have gotten $200 for you.
Yeah.
Like he did him a favor.
Yeah. are they owing?
Yeah, like you owe me something. So, now while he's in custody, Henley explained that for almost 3 years, he and Brooks had helped procure teenage boys. Some of them were their own friends for Coral, who had raped and murdered them. Coral paid $200 for each victim, we know that. And Henley gave a statement admitting that he had assisted Coral in several abductions and murders of teenage boys, informing police that Coral had buried most of his victims in a
boathouse.
There it goes.
In southwest Houston. Mm-hmm. And others at Lake Sam Rayburn and High Island Beach. Now, police were a little skeptical of Henley's claims here, assuming the sole homicide in this case was that of Coral, which they ascribed to being the result of...
If you see the torture board there, I mean, I would give it a little credence to their report.
I would think maybe they was on to something, but they believed that it was, and this is Timmy's words... Carell's death was a result of drug-fueled fisticuffs that had turned deadly.
Fisticuffs.
Drug-fueled fisticuffs.
Fisting cuffs.
Sometimes drug-fueled fisticuffs does turn deadly. Yeah.
Well, you know.
But Henley was quite insistent, however, that upon his recalling the names of three boys, Cobble, Villageast, and Jones.
That's when they knew.
And who was Jones's mother?
Mitha Jones.
He and David Brooks had procured for Coral. The police accepted that there was something to the claims, as all three teenagers were listed as missing. Now, David Hillegeist had been reported missing in summer '71. The other two boys had been just disappeared for a couple weeks. Moreover, the floor of the room where the three teenagers had been tied was covered in thick plastic sheeting. Now, that's a serial killer.
Yeah, that's
right
a sign. They
got thick
that
plastic
at the
sheeting.
TS serial killer TSK Academy.
Yeah. So anyway, also found at Coral's address were a large hunting knife.
Mm-hmm. Could be used for hunting or killing human beings.
Either way. Mm-hmm. Cleaning your fingernails, cleaning out the lint in your toenails. Mm-hmm. Rolls of clear plastic tape of the same kind used to cover the floors. Mm-hmm. A portable radio rigged to a pair of dry cells to give increased volume. And a number of dildos.
Do we know how many?
A number.
We do not know how many. There were thin glass tubes, and do you know what the thin glass tubes were for, Timmy?
Smoking crack.
No.
Are they dildos?
No.
What were they for, Colonel?
Are they for the urethra?
They were for the urethra.
Oh.
You slide a thin glass rod down in the urethra, and you hit it with your hand.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, ew.
He was very... We did not get into this podcast because it was so
grotesque.
Disgusting.
Yeah.
He was very creative in the way he would figure out ways to torture. And he would... Often when he would be done raping a boy, when he would get his own sexual satisfaction, just to hear them...
He was a cock rumble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He would use... He had this large collection of dildos that he would force entry into these young men. And I could imagine it was quite painful. And then he would use the rod trick. So he would use the hunting knife to leave cuts and marks and burns and whatnot on them. And he was a sick son of a bitch. I mean, he was one of the most vile men that ever, you know. Mm-hmm. You're going to kill somebody. I mean, some of the people just got
to come. There's no reason to torture them. I do want it noted, however, on a side note, that there is a book here that I'm looking at called Unicorn Vengeance. I'm just saying that book is out in the world, and we should all go pick it up.
Well, you know, you never want to be gored by a unicorn.
So, Colonel, tell us what happens next.
What? You know what? You don't have any room.
Well, the Ford Econoline van belonging to Coral parked in the driveway conveyed... similar clues.
Hmm.
The rear windows were sealed by opaque blue curtains.
Hmm.
In the rear of the vehicle, Police found a coil of rope, a swash of baggage rug covered in soil stains, and a wooden crate with air holes drilled in the side. The pegboard walls inside the rear of the van were rigged with several rings and hooks.
Mm.
So there was his own little... It was his
mobile
bondage machine.
Yeah, torture mobile.
And
panel vans, bad scene.
Yeah, now you nobody wants it. So anyway, another wooden crate with air holes was also found in his backyard. Inside this crate was several strands of human hair. Now, Henley agreed to accompany the police to Krell's boat shed in southwest Houston, where he claimed the bodies of most of the victims could be found. Once they got to the boat shed, started digging, they had empty bags of lime, a box full of teenage boys' clothing. They start digging, they start finding bodies. So, most of the bodies found were wrapped in thick, clear plastic sheeting. Some of them had been shot, others strangled. Sometimes the ligature, the rope, was still around their necks.
I wonder if he was related to Myra Henley. I think his name is spelled differently.
That I do not know, Timmy. I wonder if he was related to Don Henley.
Oh,
I wonder if
God.
He was related to the inventor of the Henley shirt, for Christ's sake.
Do not
sake.
Speak of Don Henley.
I'm talking about Myra Henley.
Well, I believe Don Henley. Now, here's a funny
thing.
You
know, I talk about Don Henley.
Coincidence. Let me tell you something
Come on,
crazy here, though.
We got to wrap this up.
We just spoke about Beaumont, Texas. You know where Don Henley from?
Beaumont, Texas.
Beaumont, Texas.
It's amazing.
Don Henley.
It all comes together.
He can dance there.
There was so much synergy in this podcast.
Don Henley wrote a song called The End of Innocence, and when Corel had you wrapped and tied to that board, it was The End of Innocence for you. So anyway... Why are you giving me the wrap it up thing here?
We're 2 hours into this fucking thing. Let's wrap it up.
Okay. Accompanied by his father, Brooks presented himself at the Houston police station on an evening, and he gave
presented
a statement.
Presented himself how? Wiener out?
This is a two-hour podcast.
Yeah, so Henley starts spilling his guts. They start recovering bodies everywhere. I believe they eventually came up with about 22 bodies, was it, Timmy?
Yeah, it's 28. But they think that there could be more. Correll's mother thinks that there were more.
Henley and Brooks, they was, you know, accompanied through this. They go to trial.
Mm-hmm.
Time of the killing spree was the worst case of serial murder and numbers of victims in the United States, exceeding the 25 murders of Juan Corona from California. So, it was called the Houston Mass Murders, as they became known, and hit the headlines all over the world. Even the Pope, the man with the cool hat, commented on the atrocious nature of the crimes.
I do love his hat.
And offered sympathy to the relatives who had died. Police were inundated with inquiries regarding missing boys from parents across the United States. Now, the trial of Henley and Roberts, since they both pretty much confessed everything, they were tried separately. Henley was brought to trial. He was charged with 6 murders. Prosecution called dozens of witnesses, and he was pretty much found guilty on that because it was pretty much cut and dry. He confessed that he... tied people to the board. He watched people get assaulted, shot to death, whatever. So he, you know, and then they had the other trial. So the upshot of this was Henley appealed his and won the appeal when he was tried again. And he was convicted of the 6 murders. And he was sentenced to 6 consecutive 99-year terms.
Okay, so he's going to be in jail for 594 years.
I don't think he's going to be in jail that long,
too. Well, but I'm just saying.
Now, David Brooks, he was brought to trial in 1975. He'd been indicted for 4 murders, and this was another one. It was pretty much cut and dry. They had all the evidence. The jury only deliberated for 99 minutes before they reached a verdict. But Brooks only got 1 99-year sentence. So it seems a little unfair.
Mm-hmm.
But Brooks and Henley are both serving their time in prison right now.
Down in Texas.
And Coral, he's rotting away.
Okay.
Somebody, if there, and again, he didn't really get Colonel Justice, because if he would have got Colonel Justice, someone would have tied him to the torture board, taken a, remember those old milk bottles, Timmy?
Yeah.
Shoved one of those old glass milk bottles down his urethra. Mm.
Yeah. No, I don't think that happened.
Cracked it with a baseball bat.
It's so gross.
And no, he did actually do that. Did those little, you know, those little thin Bico stirring rods?
No, I believe that you said a milk bottle, which.
Well, you have to push real hard.
I would say. Have you ever had a catheter?
Have you ever had a catheter?
Because I have. They're uncomfortable.
Quick funny story. My brother had Lou Gehrig's disease.
He's ALS. Dead. He's dead.
He could not speak.
ALS.
And I thought it would be funny. My brother's in the hospital. He's not doing real well.
He thought it'd be funny.
And the doctor comes in and clearly my brother can't talk and he's not communicating well. And the doctor says, what is he saying? And I said to the doctor, I said, my brother's saying he can't pee. And my brother's looking at me like, no, no, no. And he's giving this waving hand signal. And the doctor's like, he's not urinating? I was like, no, doctor, he's not urinating at all. He said, well, we can order a catheter and fix that. And I said, well, I believe that, you know, that's one of his problems is he's not passing urine. He's like, well, we'll do some kidney. Now, my brother can't talk. It's a true story. My brother can't talk at all. He's waving his hands, acting crazy, acting like everything, you know, and they catheterized my brother. They gave him a catheter.
I had to have one.
My brother picked on me when he was a little kid.
And so you had somebody shove things in his dick to get back at him when he was helpless. That's hilarious. What the fuck is wrong with
you? And this? I'm no longer going to participate in Ice Bucket's challenge for you.
Well, no.
Because you were a big participator.
It turned out that that the catheter was of great assistance to him because he was going into kidney failure anyway, but he didn't need the catheter at that time.
Well, they're very handy.
But but as I was telling the doctor, my brother was not urinating. It was just comical because my brother actually was having other problems. It kind of affected his he had an infection that was impaired him cognitively, but he was clear enough to understand that it's I was telling this Walters. Doctor to shove this tube down his tallywhacker.
And, well, yeah, I would think that at no point are you that
kind of. And my brother, it was like, just imagine having your mouth duct taped, you know, and my brother's like waving to the doctor, like, he lying, you know. My brother, he didn't have the disease long enough to learn how to sign or nothing other than give me the finger or wave bye bye, whatever he did. So,
Brandy.
Yes.
What's your story about being catheterized?
Oh, I had a C-section.
Oh, how was it?
Horrible.
I'm sorry. Was it worse than not having Pop-Tarts?
I don't know. It's pretty bad.
Both of them are pretty bad.
Yeah. Same. No, having a C, that was rough. Noah, my youngest, decided he was going to hang out and not come out when he was supposed to. And everybody went into distress.
Has Noah ever done what he was supposed to do?
No, that little fucker is so stubborn, I swear. But I had to get a catheter, and it was very convenient. And then I had to cough when they pulled it out, which I didn't like that because that was like, you know, a whole
thing. Yeah, but you're over that now. That's been a while, right? It's been 4 or 5 years.
Well, it's been 4 years, but do you ever really get over being violated through your urethra?
Well, I've never been violated in that nature.
Well, then you wouldn't know.
Have you ever had a prostate exam?
Well, no. But
okay, then.
Okay.
But you don't know anything about being violated.
Yeah.
Really?
True.
Yeah, that's
true.
What I'm saying.
Do you wake up in the middle of the night with stuff being shoved in your nether noddies?
Sometimes.
No.
Sometimes, yeah.
No, you do not.
It depends on the mood of Mrs. Colonel, really.
Brandy, any final thoughts on Dean Correll, the candy man?
No.
Did you like him?
No. He was kind of a dick.
He's kind of a cockwomble.
He was a cockwomble.
He was. Oh, my God, it's hotter than Satan's outhouse
in here. Colonel, your final thoughts on Dean Correll.
My final thoughts, if it were a perfect world, Dean Correll still be around.
Why are you asking?
Every day, I would come in and be able to turn the little garret that he used, the ligature, a little tighter on his testicles as he was tied to the torture board.
So, cock and ball torture for you.
I would nipple clamp him really good. I'd run just a few jolts of electricity into his into his nipples.
What about his testicles?
His testicles will have piano wire around him.
Mm-hmm.
I would let spiders go in his ears.
Okay.
And let's see, what else could we do today?
You know what? Think about it.
Yeah, you think about that. We'll get back to
you. Oh, you know what I would do? I would, because you can never really go wrong with the honey and the fire ants.
You can't go wrong.
I put some honey on his cheek right below his eyes. Yeah. And let some fire ants go on the top of his head till they ate his eyeballs out.
Brandy, where can people find us? Brandy's choking herself. You can find us on Facebook at History Dweebs, or join our podcast group at History Dweebs, the podcast group. We have a lot of folks, a lot of our listeners are active on there, so we invite you to join us. Just send us a request at History Dweebs, the podcast. Look us on Facebook. We're on Twitter. At History Dweebs 1. We're not on YouTube, nor will we ever be, apparently.
Apparently!
But find us on Stitcher and numerous other places where you can find our RSS feed. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you all again next time on History
Dweebs. Good day, listeners.
Bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.